This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. The classical musical Guys and Dolls, which opened on Broadway in 1950, has just been revived in New York again. Its music and lyrics were written almost 60 years ago by Frank Lesser. On today's Fresh Air, we'll listen back to Terry's interviews with Frank Lesser's daughter Susan and with Frank's widow, Jo Sullivan Lesser. We'll also hear some of Lesser's original demo recordings from Guys and Dolls, courtesy of Joseph Weiss. The musical, based on several Damon Runyon short stories, is about two gamblers, Nathan Detroit and Sky Masterson, and the women in their lives, one a prim do-gooder, the other a tough dame nightclub singer. The 1955 movie version starred Frank Sinatra and Marlon Brando as the gangsters. The current Broadway version stars Oliver Platt and Craig Bierko. The original Broadway show, which won the Tony Award as Best Musical, starred Robert Alda and Sam Levine. Lesser also wrote the songs for the musicals How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying and The Most Happy Fella. Early in his career, he worked as a lyricist in Hollywood, where he was matched with Hoagy Carmichael. They co-wrote Heart and Soul and Two Sleepy People. Lesser was soon writing words and music for movies. Today, we'll start by revisiting Terry's 1993 interview with his eldest child, Susan Lesser. She was born during his first marriage when he was living in Hollywood. Let's start with the title song from the original cast recording of Guys and Dolls.
Yes, sir, when you see a guy reach for stars in the sky, you can bet that he's doing it for some doll. When you spot a John waiting out in the rain, chances are he's insane, as only a John can be for a Jane. When you meet a gent paying all kinds of rent for a flat that could flatten a Taj Mahal. Call it sad, call it funny, but it's better than even money that the guy's only doing it for some dough. When you see a Joe saving half of his dough, you can bet they'll be minking it for some dough. When a bum buys wine like a bum can't afford, it's a cinch that the bum is under the thumb of some little broad. When you meet a mug lately out of the jug, and he's still lifting platinum fal de ral, call it hell, call it heaven, it's a probable 12 to 7 that the guy's only doing it for some doll. When you see a sport and his cash has run short.
I love some of the stories of Frank Lesser working with singers. Tell us a little bit about the audition for Guys and Dolls and what he had the singers do as they auditioned.
Oh, he had them yell for help. And they wouldn't understand what he meant. And he'd say, yell help. That's what I mean. He wanted to hear how loud they were. His motto was loud is good. He wanted the audience to hear every word and every note from every seat in the house. And he wanted no embellishments. He wanted his music sung note for note and loud.
In the movie version of Guys and Dolls, Frank Sinatra played the role of Nathan Detroit. And your father, the composer Frank Lesser, did not like what Sinatra was doing with Lesser's songs.
No, he didn't.
Why didn't he like it?
Well, Nathan Detroit is a very rough character, a Broadway character. And the original Nathan, Sam Levine, couldn't sing. He only had one song, Sue Me. And he came in wrong all the time on the first note. So my father had to write him a four-bar phrase, call a lawyer, and if you listen to it, I will not sing it. It slides up to the correct note to come in on. That was how bad Sam sang, but he was also brilliant and wonderful and rough and tough and Runyonesque, whereas Frank Sinatra was very smooth and crooned his songs. And in fact, Goldwyn had my father write three more songs for Nathan in the movie, for Frank Sinatra. And my father would listen to Sinatra rehearse and would become angrier and angrier. And finally, they had it out, and my father kind of met his match with Frank Sinatra, who exploded about the same way my father did, both of them screaming words that I won't say on the radio. As it ended, Frank Sinatra, of course, performed the songs his way, and they never spoke again.
Did your father sing around the house a lot?
He sang when he was working on something. More often he played the piano, mm-hmm. working on songs. But yes, he sang too, and he and my mother worked out songs together. There are some wonderful old recordings of them singing Baby It's Cold Outside and Make a Miracle from Where's Charlie?
Yeah, it's interesting. You write about how Baby It's Cold Outside used to be your parents' song, and they would sing
yes.
it at parties together until it was actually used in a film.
Right. And my mother adored that because they would go to parties, and after the first time they sang the song, they were in great demand because it was such a wonderful, fun song, and they had such a good time singing it together, and they were very good performers of it. And so my mother felt it was her claim to fame at that time to perform this song at parties, and when he sold it to MGM for a movie called Neptune's Daughter with Esther Williams and Ricardo Montalban, it broke my mother's heart. She was very upset about losing the song. But then it won an Academy Award, so it made up for it.
Your life must have really changed dramatically when you were 12 and 13. That's when you moved to New York from Hollywood.
Yes.
Your father's show, Most Happy Fellow, opened on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And it was during that show that he fell in love with his second wife, Joe Sullivan.
Right.
And left your mother. And your mother was actually involved in introducing Joe Sullivan to Frank Lesser.
My mother did a lot of the casting for The Most Happy Fellow. She was co-producer with Kermit Bloomgarden. And when she heard Joe sing, she said, boy, this is a voice. This is a voice and a personality Frank would just love. So she sent Joe to audition for my father, sealing her fate. It was a very hard time for everybody. My brother and I were uprooted from our California suburban lifestyle and brought to New York City. We at first stayed with friends and then moved to a small apartment. My mother was not happy and was drinking more and more, and I had never lived in such close quarters with her before, and that was when I began to see that she had big problems. Everything changed for all of us. My father was living across Central Park in an apartment of his own and having his affair with Joe. And everybody was, he wasn't real happy either. It was a time full of turmoil. Although for him, I think it was mitigated a great deal by the great success of The Most Happy Fella. I think, you know, for him, that show was so important. He wrote not only the music and the lyrics, but he wrote the book, and he was involved day to day with every aspect of it to Joe Anthony, the director's great consternation. My father attempted to direct it as well.
When you were growing up and still living in the same house with your father, did you ever eavesdrop on him while he was writing a song?
Well, I didn't really have to eavesdrop. He had a little organ in his room, and I would stop there on my way down to breakfast because he was a very early riser, and he would already be deep at work. But I didn't see it as work. I didn't know what he was doing. He would be playing a phrase over and over again on the organ, and then he would get up and pace for a while, and then he'd sit in his chair and smoke 7 or 8 cigarettes and drink some more coffee and get up and play some more music. And I'd say, what are you doing? And he'd say, I'm working.
Right.
And, you know, that was another one of those surreal mysteries to me.
Is there any song that you feel particularly a part of because you were either with him while he was writing it, or you heard it ringing through the house, or he told you about it, or...
I think the song of his that means the most to me is a very small, short song in Guys and Dolls, and it's called My Time of Day. And it's a poem, it's an ode to New York at 4 in the morning when the when the street lamps light the gutter with gold. It was a song that Sky Masterson sings to Sarah Brown, and it really characterizes my father, I think. I think that, he liked that song the best in that show, and I, to me, that song is my father.
Well, Susan Lesser, it's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for talking with us.
My time of day is the dark time, a couple of deals before dawn, when the street belongs to the cop and the janitor with a mop, and the grocery clerks are all gone. When the smell of the rain-washed pavement comes up clean and fresh and cold, and the street lamp light fills the gutter with gold, that's my time of day. My time of day, and you're the only doll I've ever wanted to share it with me.
Our salute to the musical Guys and Dolls, now being revived on Broadway, continues. When Frank Lesser wrote his shows, he made demo recordings to demonstrate to the cast what the song should sound like. Those demos were discovered years later by Joseph Weiss, the copyright manager of Paul McCartney's publishing company, which acquired Lesser's publishing company in 1979. Along with the acquisition came hundreds of unindexed tapes. Weiss listened to those tapes and discovered, to his delight, that some of them featured Lesser himself. Terry spoke with Joseph Weiss in 1992 when a CD of those demos was released. We'll start with a sample from the Guys and Dolls demos. Lesser's voice is the first one you'll hear on this trio version of Fugue for Tin Horns.
I got the horse right here, her name is Paul Revere, and here's a guy that says if the weather's clear, can do. Can do. This guy says the horse can do. If he says the horse can do, can do, can do.
Are you crazy? I'm picking Valentine, 'cause on the morning line, the guy has got him figured at 5 to 9.
But look at Epitaphy, where's it by a half? According to this hearing on Telegraph, I tell you, Epitaph.
Paul,
I got the horse right here.
Valentine, besides the jockey's brother's a friend of mine.
Not just a minute, boys, I got the feed box noise. It says the great-grandfather was equipoise.
For Paul Revere, I'll fight, I hear his foot's all right. Of course,
this guy says the horse shows
right last night.
I tell you, Epitaph.
Paul,
I got the horse right here.
Tell me what the experience was like the first time you found one of these Frank Lesser demo recordings and you put it on and heard it.
It's a very hard thing to explain. Not only because of how great the recordings themselves are, but because of how I feel about Frank Lesser. It was very exciting experience, and it was immediately satisfying. The first time that I heard his voice, I wasn't even sure it was his voice. It was a guess because it was one of his songs. I honestly don't remember now which one it was, but it was clearly not a commercial singer, and it was just that interesting voice with a piano. There are, I'd say, five geniuses in musical theater whose names always come up when we talk about the creation of American musical theater. And they are George Gershwin, Jerome Kern, Richard Rodgers, Irving Berlin, and Cole Porter. And I always feel that there should be a sixth name in there, that Frank Lesser's name belongs in that group. And there are a few reasons it probably doesn't show up there. One of them is that his output for Broadway was only 5 scores, and it only spanned 15 years. and that he's actually a later writer than the rest of them. He wasn't there for the formative years, which all of the others were. And he also wasn't excessively self-promoting, which is not to say the others were, but that had he chosen to do so, I think his name could have become a household word just like the others.
Well, one of just the revelations of this record is listening to Frank Lesser sing "Sue Me" from Guys and Dolls, and this is a different version of it than you'd hear on any of the cast recordings or in any of the shows. Do you want to describe what's different about it?
Yes. Well, two things are different. One is that it's not a duet, which is the way the song is done in the show. And it also has a verse which isn't used in the show. And it's a very sweet, low-key, subtle, as far as the comedy is concerned, version of the song. It's not only done this way on this demonstration recording. It was actually published this way at the time Guys and Dolls opened on Broadway. And there were recordings by other artists in this style.
Now, in the original cast recording, Sam Levine sang the part, or played the part, I should say, yeah, of Nathan Detroit. That's the same part that was played by Frank Sinatra in the movie. And Sam Levine couldn't sing, so he just kind of, like, brays this song. You know, he just kind of hollers the song, whereas Frank Lesser sings it as a lovely ballad with really kind of funny lyrics.
Yes.
Why don't we hear Frank Lesser singing "Sue Me"?
So you're all the time right, and I'm all the time wrong. So my character's weak, and your character's strong. So your brow is so high, and my brow is so low. Well, brow, schmow, I'm close to you now. And all I can tell you is, oh, go sue me, sue me. What can you do me? I love you. Give a holler and hate me, hate me. Go ahead, hate me, I love you. All right already, I'm just a no good Nick. All right already, it's true, so new, so sue me. Sue me, what can you do me? I love you.
You got these Frank Lesser demonstration discs just in a kind of bundle, I guess. How come do you think they weren't taken better care of?
Well, I think the reason they weren't taken better care of is that, to a large extent, I don't think the people who were handling the catalog for several years realized that that's what was there. The way discs and tapes of this kind are often marked would be as simple as a label that says "Luck Be a Lady." And there would be hundreds of discs marked "Luck Be a Lady" in a catalog like that. And most of the time, they'd identify the artist. On a demonstration disc, the artist is rarely identified, whether it's a commercial singer or the original composer. So I don't think that anyone neglected material because they didn't care, but just because it wasn't obvious that it was there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the things that made it such a pleasure to play through the material, was that if I picked up a disc that said "Luck Be a Lady" and dropped the needle on it, I didn't know if I was going to hear just another reference dub of the cast album or if the voice that came over the speakers was going to be the genius who wrote the song.
What a thrill this all must have been.
It was. It was. The period, it was about 10 years ago that all of this took place, that my playing through the recordings took place. And I was fairly new to the music business at the time. And it was an incredible experience for me. It was, now it occurs as a very sweet, romantic period for me to be new to the business and yet have the privilege of listening. And listening alone in the late hours of the day, to material that probably hadn't been heard by anyone for decades.
Joseph Weiss, speaking with Terry Gross in 1992, the year Weiss produced a CD of Frank Lesser demo recordings. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. A revival of the 1950 Tony-winning musical Guys and Dolls has just opened on Broadway. We're concluding our salute to its composer, Frank Lesser, by revisiting Terry's 2006 interview with his widow, Jo Sullivan Lesser. She starred in Lesser's 1956 production of A Most Happy Fella and became his second wife. Joe Sullivan Lesser told Terry what it was like to live with such a creative, driven husband.
He was a handful. He used to go to bed at 12 o'clock at night, and around 12, and get up at 4 in the morning. And from 4 in the morning till 8 o'clock in the morning, he would write, and on a silent piano, thankfully. And that's because the telephone couldn't bother him. He could write and compose and be completely clear about that. He would also get in the car, and you would drive him around, and he would write in the car because the telephone couldn't get to him, too, at the same time. So then in the morning when I would get up, 7:30 or whatever, he would be having a martini, and I would be having a cup of coffee because he'd been up for 4 hours. So he was having lunch, and I was having breakfast. It was kind of a funny arrangement.
Frank Lesser was a kind of interesting singer himself. He recorded some demos that were a few years ago put together on CD. And I really love that recording. So I thought we could pause here and listen to one of them. I thought we'd hear him singing something he wrote for Guys and Dolls, I'll Know. But before we hear it, what did you think of these demos? And did you have any of his demos when you were preparing to perform in Most Happy Fella?
No, we did not. We did not. But we put that album together to make sure that he sang. I thought he sang terrific. I mean, let's face it, he didn't have a very beautiful voice, but he certainly knew how to put a lyric over. I mean, you could see how important the lyrics were to him. And I think it shows on this album. I think it's great fun to listen to.
No, me too. Well, let's hear it. This is Frank Lesser singing one of his songs from Guys and Dolls, I'll Know.
I'll know when my love comes along. I'll know then and there. I'll know at the sight of her face. How I care, how I care, how I care. And I'll stop and I'll stare and I'll know.
That's Frank Lesser on an album of demo records that was put together called An Evening with Frank Lesser. My guest is his widow, the singer Joe Sullivan Lesser. You know, we heard Frank Lesser singing one of his songs. What was his attitude towards singers and musicians who took liberties with either his lyrics or the music? And I'm talking about on their own records. I'm not talking about when they were appearing in a production of one of his shows.
I don't think he cared when they were on a record. I know that he used to say to me, oh, let him do that. That song is so famous, it doesn't make any difference. That would happen often. But if you did decide that you were going to do something and change the way you sang or whatever, his rhythm or whatever he wrote in a show, then there was a lot of trouble. And in How to Succeed, he had such a fight with Rudy Valley. You know, Rudy Valley had been singing for many, many years and said, listen, I don't need anybody to tell me how to sing a song. Well, Frank said, well, you're going to sing my song this way. They almost came to blows. But the fact was that Frank quit the show, which when he came home, I said to him, I think you've gone a little far this time, Frank, for God's sakes. But he quit the show, and they had to beg him and cajole him to come back, and of course he did. And then when they were recording, when they made the movie of Guys and Dolls, Frank Sinatra would not sing the songs the way Frank wanted him to. And Frank wrote him a great song called Adelaide. And Sinatra and he never spoke after that. They had such a fight that they never spoke after that movie.
What exactly was the fight about?
Because Sinatra would not sing Frank's songs the way he wanted him to.
Melodically
or
lyrically?
He was going to croon him more than that, and Frank didn't like it and didn't think it suited the part.
Oh.
And I think he was right.
So who won in the movie of Guys and Dolls? Was it Sinatra or Frank Lesser?
I think that Sinatra sang it the way he wanted to.
Now, your husband, Frank Lesser, died at, what was he, like 59?
59 years old, yes.
Of lung cancer after you were married about 10 years.
Yes, we were.
And he left to you... What, his publishing company, which was publishing rights to all of his songs?
Yes, yes. He left to me his publishing company. He was a superb businessman, and he'd built himself up a little empire. and he left me a company that leased shows to all the schools and stock and everything, and a publishing company. And in that publishing company, he had many young composers that he had helped and sponsored their careers. And one is Richard Adler, and who wrote Pajama Game with Jerry Ross, and Meredith Wilson, and Bob Wright and Chet Forrest, and Charlie Strauss, and all of these young men he helped. And I really admired that a great deal. Frank's motto for composers was improve the breed, and he tried to. And I wish people would do that today. I wish somebody would really help all these wonderful young composers that are coming up and give them money so they can write and they can work. So I wish somebody would do that.
So what were some of the difficult decisions you had to make about rights to his songs and rights to his musicals?
Well, I remember that he told me, first of all, we never allowed anyone to sing Adelaide's Lament on television. And Frank told me that don't let them sing the big songs too much. Save them for big moments because they'll ruin it. So I keep Luck Be a Lady. Every week, two or three times, somebody calls and wants to do Luck Be a Lady. And I don't let them do it. Very, very seldom do I.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
And thank you so much for asking me. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Joe Sullivan Lesser, speaking with Terry Gross in 2006. Playwright and screenwriter Horton Foote died in his sleep earlier this week. At age 92, he was still writing, fine-tuning his nine-play classic known as The Orphan's Home Cycle for a new production scheduled to open in New York next season. His most recent play, Dividing the Estate, is a good bet for a Tony nomination this year. He wrote his first play, the one-act Wharton Dance, in 1940. In the intervening 69 years, Horton Foote won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama for his play Atlanta. He won Academy Awards for his adaptation of To Kill a Mockingbird, starring Gregory Peck, and for his original screenplay for Tender Mercies, starring Robert Duvall. Both actors won Oscars as well. Also, Geraldine Page won an Oscar for her performance in Foote's movie A Trip to Bountiful. Like much of his writing, A Trip to Bountiful was based on Horton Foote's memories of growing up in the small town of Horton, Texas. A Trip to Bountiful is about an elderly woman who is forced to leave such a town when her son gets a job in Houston. Her fantasy is to leave Houston and return to her old home, but when she summons up the strength to leave her son, she finds that Bountiful virtually no longer exists. The houses are boarded up, and the day before she arrives, the last resident of Bountiful has died. All she can do is take one last look at her home. Before we hear Terry's 1988 interview with Horton Foote, here's Geraldine Page in a scene from Foote's 1985 screen adaptation of his 1953 play.
That's all I want, just to see it, just to stand on the porch of my own house again.
Lady, I don't have anything
to... I thought last night that I had to stay. I thought I would just die if I couldn't stay. But now, I'll settle for less. An hour. Half an hour.
Horton Foote, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
And to start our interview, I'd actually like to ask you to read something from your new book of plays, something from the introduction that you wrote about change in your life.
All right, be happy to. Change was an early acquaintance in my life. My grandfather, who seemed impervious to all mortal ends, died when I was 9. And the reverberations and changes from that death continued for many years. It was soon after that I was to see a quiet, serene street in front of my grandparents' house begin its slow but steady descent into a metaphor for all the ugly, trashy highways that scar a great deal of small-town America. And these plays, I feel, are about change, unexpected, unasked for, unwanted, but to be faced and dealt with, or else we sink into despair or a hopeless longing for a life that's gone.
Well, I think that theme of change is not only apparent in the cycle of plays that has just been published, but also it's apparent in several of your movies, such as A Trip to Bountiful. And I'm wondering what kind of changes you've had to deal with in your life that has made the idea of coping with change such a potent one in your writing.
Well, I think anybody has to deal with change because life is constantly changing. And the perceptions that you have that you try to hold on to when you're young, so many things. I mean, people move away and houses are sold and people die and new life comes into focus. And there are cycles of drought and cycles of too much rain. There is the unexpected is always there. And I think you really have to kind of find yourself not thrown by this and take life as it is, each moment as best you can.
A Trip to Bountiful is about trying to return to the past and realizing that the past is always out of reach and that you can't really get back there. And you write in the introduction to your new plays that your first memory was of stories about the past.
Yes.
But that it didn't take you long for you to learn that the past was gone and nothing could be done about it. And I wonder if there was a turning point in your realization of that, just as there was for the character in A Trip to Bountiful.
Well, I learned that lesson very early because I was raised on stories of I'm a Southerner, and my family have been in the area that I was born in for many, many years. And as I was growing up, I was told of all the things that the family had had and were lost and never to be gotten back. And so I soon learned that you had to give that up. I mean, so many of my family spent their lives in regretting that and being defeated by it. But I soon learned that that's death.
Do you ever feel that some of your plays are misunderstood and that people think that your plays are about returning to the past instead of learning to give it up?
They think they're nostalgic, and they're not at all. I have a certain desire to be fair to the past and as exact as I can be about the past, even a past that I've only heard about orally and haven't really lived through, because so many of my plays are based on stories that were passed down to me by other people. I certainly think there are certain values in the past that we would be foolish to ignore and not to cherish and not to try to learn from. But I have no desire. I was thinking this morning, every day you read, what a terrible age we live in. Well, I've heard that all my life.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think any age is really any worse. They're just new problems, it's all, and different problems.
Let's talk about Tender Mercies, the screenplay that you won an Academy Award for a few years ago. Now, Robert Duvall starred as a country and western songwriter and singer whose career derails because of alcoholism. And as he's trying to get sober, he falls in love with a young, very humble widow and moves in with her and her son. Why don't we hear a clip from that movie?
I don't know if I was what you call rich, but I had a few dollars.
How'd you get it?
Writing songs.
And how'd you get money for that?
Well, people are crazy enough to pay for it, they do it.
What happened to your money?
I lost it.
How?
Too much Applejack.
You think you'll ever be rich again?
Well, I tell you what, Sonny, I don't lay awake nights worrying about it. No. Now, look, there's a D, right? D is in dog. Now, watch me. I'll call him out. I've decided to leave G here forever. Not really. Let me know if you're staying behind. It's A7.
What did you relate to about that character that you created for Tender Mercies?
I really took as my model people I'd known in the theater. I didn't really know a lot about country western singing or singers, but I had known many people in the theater who were stars or near stars, who had been defeated in some measure by alcoholism, and once in a while they'd defeated that and found a way to continue. So that really was kind of in my mind all the time I was creating Max Sledge.
Well, you know, you won an Academy Award for To Kill a Mockingbird. I want to play just a very short scene from it. The film starred Gregory Peck, and here he is.
How old were you when you got your first gun, Atticus?
13 or 14. I remember when my daddy gave me that gun. He told me that I should never point at anything in the house, and that he'd rather I'd shoot at tin cans in the backyard. But he said that sooner or later he supposed the temptation to go after birds would be too much, and that I could shoot all of the blue jays I wanted if I could hit them. But to remember, it was a sin to kill a mockingbird.
Why?
Well, I reckon because mockingbirds don't do anything but make music for us to enjoy. Don't need people's gardens. Don't nest in the corn cribs. They don't do one thing but just sing their hearts out for us.
The screenplay you wrote was an adaptation from a novel?
Mm-hmm, by Harper Lee.
You did a lot of adaptations. You adapted Faulkner for Playhouse 90.
I did a lot. Not a lot. I've done, well, let me see. I did Faulkner. I did Harper Lee. I did Flannery O'Connor.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not bad. I mean, if you're going to adapt, that's the kind of things you should adapt.
Was it fulfilling work to do adaptations?
Well, it's difficult work. It's not work that I relish because it's painful. Because, it's first of all, there's an enormous responsibility to a fellow artist. And secondly, it's painful to try to get into somebody else's psyche, you know, and to put on somebody else's skin, as it were, and to try to understand emotionally what the work is about.
Now, another of your plays, called 1918, is about death by flu. It's during the flu epidemic of 1918, and death by war, World War I.
Yeah.
Did you hear a lot of stories about both when you were growing up?
Well, yes, but more about the flu than about the war, really.
Well, families lost a lot of people during
the actually, the flu epidemic killed more people than the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, it knew no boundaries. I mean, the people that the war couldn't get, I mean, women and children and kings and queens, the flu got. And it was a devastation. And I, in working on it, I thought it was interesting that actually I did the play first of all down at the HB, and when Herbert saw it, he said, you know what this play is about? And I often don't know what my plays are about, so I was happy to hear. And he said, this play is about expected death and unexpected death. And I thought about it for a moment, and I said, of course it is, because the expected death was what will happen if you go to France or to the war, and the unexpected death was the flu, which just quietly came into a house, and nobody was expecting it, and took people, killed them.
Mm-hmm. You know, talking about death reminds me of a line that's very moving from A Trip to Bountiful. It's one of Geraldine Page's lines. And in explaining why she wants to go back to the home she grew up in and that she raised her children in, she says that two of her babies are buried there.
Mm.
And it made me really think about the pull that the dead exert on you from the place where, you know, where your loved ones are buried.
Yeah.
Is that something you've thought about a lot?
Well, as a matter of fact, what has always haunted me is when I was growing up, and we often, because my grandfather's death, my grandmother often went out to the cemetery, and she'd take me with her. And there in the family plot were two graves of children of hers that had died as infants. And I constantly thought about them, and it was never mentioned, never talked about. I never even saw a picture of them, but there they were, and certainly the memory of them must have lived on in all these people, you know. And it's something that is, it does have its own reality for you.
Okay, well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Horton Foote, speaking to Terry Gross in 1988. The Oscar, Emmy, and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer died in his sleep earlier this week. DC Comics first published Watchmen, a grim, violent superhero comic book by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons, in 12 issues in 1986 and 1987. It's the story of a band of aging superheroes who come together to thwart nuclear war. And it was an immediate sensation whose influence has yet to wane. The new movie is among the year's most anticipated. It's directed by Zack Snyder, who also adapted the graphic novel 300 for the screen. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Watchmen is the most faithful film adaptation of a comic book ever, and many of its fans will be thrilled by every frame. They'll say, "Wow, this is so much like the original." I think they'll be more thrilled by the fact of its fidelity than by the movie itself. On the other hand, non-fans might wonder what the hullabaloo is about. Now, I'm a fan of the comic anyway, which is splashy and blood-drenched and induces a kind of delirium. The reader's eyes race forward, circle back, and dart around the panels while the brain labors to synthesize the data. Writer Alan Moore and illustrator Dave Gibbons give us every kind of superhero crusader, from Night Owl, the old-fashioned idealist in a cape, to the comedian, a paramilitary sociopath, to Silk Spectre, a curvy femme. They try to solve a murder mystery and forestall nuclear Armageddon, but the narrative is always jumping ahead and doubling back. There are several narrators, among them Rorschach, the unkempt right-wing nihilist in a stocking cap mask, and Dr. Manhattan, an iridescent blue giant in a cosmic funk, who flees Earth for Mars, where he stews and sifts through old memories. There are flashbacks and flashbacks within flashbacks. There are fat chunks of prose. There are backstories that are literally that. They play out at the rear of the frame. Moore and Gibbons used every tool they could invent to push the comics medium to its limit, to make their storytelling leap from the page. So when I read that Zack Snyder, the director of the $125 million movie, had vowed to stay true to the original spirit by moving the camera as little as possible on the premise that comics are laid out a frame at a time, I had a premonition of doom. Capturing the headlong spirit of Watchmen would call for a director to push the film medium to its limit, not cast off many of the medium's best tools. Watchmen is dead on the screen. But I got to admit, it's some corpse, huge, loud, and gaseously distended by its own dystopia. The novel's narrative jumble has been meticulously preserved. In the movie's overture, a dark figure heaves aging superhero the comedian, played by Jeffrey Dean Morgan, out a skyscraper window, and members of the vigilante collective The Watchmen, which had disbanded, dust off their costumes and get back in touch. One of the first flashbacks is of how they joined forces. The comedian was a cynic, but billionaire Adrian Veidt, whose superhero persona is called Ozymandias and is played by Matthew Good, thought they could make a difference.
Watchmen. That's the real joke.
Look, Rorschach and I have made real headway on the gang problem by working together.
We can do so much more. We can save this world. With the right leadership.
And that'd be you, right, Ozzy? I mean, hell, you're the smartest man on the planet.
Doesn't take a genius to see the world has problems.
Yeah, but it takes a room full of morons to think they're small enough for you to handle. You know, mankind has been trying to kill each other off since the beginning of time. Now, we finally have the power to finish the job. Ain't nothing gonna matter once those nukes start flying, we'll all be dust.
The prospect of annihilation looms large in Watchmen. This is still the Cold War, the 80s, and Richard Nixon has somehow managed to be reelected. He watches the Soviets amass on the Afghan border and orders his bombers armed. The comic book was conceived at the height of the 80s disarmament movement, after Reagan's election inspired waves of fresh doomsday scenarios, and its resolution, which the film reproduces, has dated badly. It was outlandish then. Now, on film, it seems both insanely pessimistic and insanely naive, an anticlimactic bummer. Almost every character is weighed down by hopelessness, but some of the actors come through amid the special effects. Jackie Earle Haley gives Rorschach a great soulful rasp, And while Dr. Manhattan is a special effect laid over actor Billy Crudup's face, Crudup's melancholy registers. His scenes on Mars have a chill beauty. But numbness settles over the movie. Director Snyder's reverence isn't the kind that gives life. It's an embalmer's reverence. It preserves, but it drains out all the blood.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.